I'm Paul Sullivan, your host on the Company of Dads podcast, where we explore the sweet, sublime, strange, and silly aspects of being a lead dad in a world where men often feel they have to hide or at least not talk about their parenting role. Today, my guest is Laura Bazelon, attorney, author, and mother of two. She has a new book out called Ambitious Like a Mother, with the subtitle, Why Prioritizing Your Career is Good for Your Kids. But as I read about the book, I realized it's perfect for this moment in time when we come out of the pandemic, where whole groups of people have been able to work from home. And that's allowed spouses to see exactly what the other one is doing and when. Not surprisingly, it's caused tension. When I read more, I immediately reached out. In so many ways, the Company of Dads stands to provide another way of being a father and husband than some of the stories, fantastic, fascinating stories that she tells, including her own. Welcome to the Company of Dads podcast, Laura. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
64% of women earn more in the family or are equal to their spouse. So in what percentage of those households are women still working the second shift or doing the majority of the parenting?
The vast majority. The statistics are pretty daunting in that the second shift has not really been reduced over time. And then, of course, during the pandemic, it really metastasized. And overwhelmingly, a lot of the domestic responsibilities, including homeschooling, making three meals a day plus snacks, fell to the mothers. And of course, you couldn't outsource it anymore to babysitters and nannies or even grandparents because of the restrictions and the quarantine.
Yeah. I mean, why? Why? You have, you know, if you're in a position where you're able to work from home, I don't want to be too presumptuous, but you're a high achiever, you have a job that allows you some flexibility, you're both there, you both have the same constraints. Why does the pandemic not work as a catalyst to change this and to get dads to step up a bit?
I was asking myself the same question, and I think it's a couple of things. Part of it is that women are socialized to believe that it's their job to really hold up the vast majority of responsibilities in the house, and that somehow we're being told that we're quote unquote better at it. And when you really break it down, are women any better at changing a diaper or making a doctor's appointment or carpooling a kid to soccer practice? No. And yet we're the ones who feel that we're supposed to be doing all of that. There's an interesting study that came out and they looked at married women versus divorced and single women. And divorced and single women do a lot less housework. And the reason the authors found was because some of the domestic labor that women did was actually performative. They felt like they were supposed to be doing X, Y, and Z thing, even if it wasn't sort of absolutely necessary. So it wasn't that single and divorced women were living in sloth and filth. It was that they didn't feel like they had to present in this very specific, curated way. So I think that's one aspect of it. And then I think the other aspect of it, and this came out with a lot of the moms that I interviewed, is that they think that if they outsource this to the dads, it will be done differently and worse. And so they will admit to being resentful and at the same time, not want to give up control because they're worried that maybe the doctor's appointment won't get made or it'll get made a couple of months late or the dinner won't taste very good. And so part of it is, I think you just have to, if you want parity, accept that there's going to be a learning curve in a lot of these more traditional heterosexual relationships and that things aren't going to be done exactly to your standard. Hopefully they'll get better, but they probably never will be. And you're going to have to accept that if what you want is equality.
I'm still kind of stuck on housework as performance art. This sounds like something that would never be in the Whitney Biennial. But I hear that. And one of the early podcasts I did was with a professor at the University of Georgia named Kristen Shockley. And she was able to do some remarkable research during the pandemic in which she had a data set of people who were at home. Some of them were frontline workers. They had to go out, but it was heterosexual couples married with children at home. And she sort of did this screen to see, you know, which couples were the happiest. So not surprisingly, the couples that were the most unhappy or the least happy were the ones in which, you know, one spouse did 100% of everything and also worked her job. Traditionally, typically it was a woman. The ones that were the happiest though were not the ones that had some sort of 50-50 mix. It was the ones where one person did the majority and then the other person was prepared to help out when necessary. And she couldn't say if that was the father or the mother, and she didn't want to, you know, take a guess. But essentially, the basic point was, you know, what I try to get at it in the company of dads is sort of almost like a 70-30 split. You know, and you could have a lead mom too, but if that person is doing sort of 70% of stuff and the other person picks up 30, you know that you're picking up the slack. In the case of this professor's research, Dr. Shockley's research, it was really that if one parent who was doing the majority of the work knew that she had an outlet, knew that she had somebody who, when she had that key work call that could not be disturbed, her spouse would really, you know, step in. And a lot of the lead dads I've talked to, they embrace the role, but they also love their calendar, and their calendar is very rigid. When you were doing it research for your book and you were talking to women who were able to sort of, you know, find some sort of parity or find a spouse who, or partner who was able to help out and allow them to sort of do what they want to do professionally, but not grow, not feel overwhelmed by the second ship or grow resentful of that spouse. What were the things that made it work in that relationship? When they talked to you about, okay, you know, I had XYZ problem with my spouse, but we had this discussion and now we've come up with a solution so we can both fulfill our professional goals, but one of us doesn't feel like he or she is doing all the grunt work at home.
I have a two-part answer. The people who tended to be the most successful as a married couple were the people who had what I call the boring conversations. When you're in love in the early throes of a relationship and you're just so excited and you can't wait to spend the rest of your life with this person, you're not actually going to sit down and say, when it comes down to brass tacks and we have two kids or three kids, who's going to be doing what? And where do you see yourself 5 or 10 years from now? Nobody really engages in those conversations. They're
I did taking out the trash as taking out the trash as performance art. I really, you know, how did I know that would come in handy? I'm lying. That's not true.
Well, if you had, you would be a pioneer among other things. And so, you know, and I'm totally guilty of this. I didn't have any of those conversations with my now ex-husband, from whom I'm amicably divorced. But if we had, I think we would have found that we had really different expectations about how things were going to look once we became parents, which we then very rapidly did. So the people who do the best tend to sort of at least talk it through in advance and have some idea, which isn't to say that they're locked into what they've talked about, but they at least can sketch it out and imagine it. So that's, I think, the first part of the recipe, in my opinion, for having successful parity, I think, or some degree of it, I should say. And I think the other part of it is this idea of a seesaw marriage, which is that things can be wildly imbalanced. And I think what a lot of married people take comfort in is the idea that it's going to swing the other way at some point. So I've had some of the mothers that I've interviewed say, you know, I spent a few years not working terribly hard or working part-time. My husband worked a lot. I did a lot more of the domestic labor. Now I'm back in the workforce and my husband has picked up the slack at home. And it's sort of this understanding that there is going to be reckoning is the wrong word because that sounds like a bad outcome, but there's going to be a reconciliation in that things move back and forth and it isn't always going to be one way.
I mean, do you think that seesaw marriage, do you think that was just luck or were those couples having the discussion like, okay, I'm going to step back for, you know, 3 or 4 years, you run with it, and then we're going to equalize things later on down the road?
Normally it was the latter. They would really talk it through and say, okay, we're going to have a baby. We're going to have a second child. We're going to have a third child. It's going to be a game changer for us. What is this going to look like in terms of our family unit and our family structure? And are you willing to do X, Y, and Z for me if I do that for you 3 to 5 years from now?
Yeah, I was talking to a couple guys in the past weeks where they've, you know, when their kids got older, they did exactly that. Like their wives were home earlier on and their wives, you know, big careers went back and they took a step back and now they're there with the sort of, you know, junior high school age kids. And it seems to be working well. But again, you know, they were all comfortable with it. They talked it through. My question is, when you look at, you know, you talked about it at the top of this about sort of the models that women have and sort of, you know, housework as performance art. We can blame the baby boomers for a lot and we should blame them regularly when things go wrong. I mean, blame's important and they should shoulder a lot of it. But do you think they were just particularly poor role models for us? I mean, what do people do who don't have a good role model to follow or don't have the ability to sort of, you know, course correct when they realize what they're doing in the relationship isn't working or what they're doing as parents and workers isn't working?
Well, I would love to blame the baby boomers for everything, including inclement weather, because they've left us with a climate that's on fire, a political system in complete disarray. You and I could go on and on. I think because of the way that norms were changing when they were becoming parents, they were in this really tricky situation. They were kind of caught betwixt and between. So, I mean, my parents, I think, are a good example of this. They got married in the 60s. They did something, I think, pretty untraditional, and that my mom went to medical school and went on to have a career as a physician while also having four children. And she was married to somebody very traditional in that, while my dad was supportive of her career, he really had no interest in how our household operated other than to understand that she was going to make sure that the train was going to run on time. And that was the model that I grew up with, which seemed pretty impossible to me.
Yeah.
Just the amount of responsibility and stress. I don't remember my mother ever sitting still. And then I think the other motto was more dad goes to work kind of Mad Men style. Mm-hmm. Mom stays home or works part-time or maybe volunteers at the school. And at least around me, there weren't really other role models to look at.
So what do we do? If we didn't have those good role models, what do we do now?
I think that to some degree, we have to imagine the lives that we want for ourselves and then and live them, even if they're wildly imperfect. Because when you don't have a template to work from, what that means is that you have to create the wheel, not recreate it, but actually create it, because there isn't the wheel for you. And so that process can be stressful and laborious, but I also think it's a worthwhile enterprise. And I feel like with my own family, that's what we have slowly been trying to do in fits and starts with greater and lesser degrees of success.
Yeah. If you don't mind, I mean, tell me a bit about your own story. When I read about this, you know, it's in a book, so it's no secret here, but that, you know, you had career aspirations and your then husband wasn't supportive or wasn't supportive in a way that would have made it work. But now you just said you're amicably divorced. So it seems to be, you know, it's coming out okay, but that's not the outcome that anyone sets out to have when they get married. So what was the process for you? And, you know, is your ex-husband now, is he more of a lead dad now that he has to have the kids half the time? Is he stepping up?
I'm smiling because I'm wondering what he would think of that expression. I have to run it by him. He is an extremely present parent. He has always been that way. He's a devoted dad, and he is interested in doing things that I'm not particularly interested in, sitting through my son's endless little league games being maybe one thing, and watching endless baseball games on TV and things like that. At confession, I find baseball hopelessly boring, and I know that means I've alienated your entire audience. And he does step up, and he does absolutely pull his weight. And I think if you asked him, he would say in the early years of the kids' lives, he was working 80, 90 hour weeks at a big law firm, and he was an associate, and he didn't have a lot of control over his schedule. And now he still works a ton, but I think because he's able to do it kind of around the custody schedule, he has more flexibility to be with the children. And so I do really think that it's a pretty functional partnership. And it's interesting. It's not like he didn't think I was always going to work, because when we met, I had already been a federal public defender, I think, for 6 or 7 years. So he knew who I was, that I worked all the time, that I was very ambitious. I think he just thought once we had children, I would downshift. And instead, I weirdly upshifted. And I'm not sure that I even could have predicted that.
But, and finish that thought. And this is a conversation that you didn't have when you were first married or when you first started having kids as to what people were going to do, or you had the conversation and it wasn't a satisfactory conversation?
We didn't have many conversations, in part because we had kind of a whirlwind relationship where we fell in love and within a year we were engaged. And then shortly after that, I got pregnant with our son. So when we got married, I was already pregnant, and then we were parents basically almost immediately. And then 2 years later, we had another child. So we were really thrown into it. And also at the same time, the recession hit, which made things very dicey for us professionally for a number of years. We just had a lot of stress, and it just felt like, I mean, you know this, when you have young kids, you're just underwater, barely able to acknowledge each other sometimes in the mess of diapers and dishes and chores and endless mess. And so I don't think that we really terribly well thought out any the situation that we found ourselves in, other than I think by the time the second child came along, we did have this decision point where I was offered this job that I really wanted that was in LA. We were living in San Francisco. He did not want to move to LA because his family was in San Francisco. His job was in San Francisco. Our house was in San Francisco. That's all perfectly valid. But I didn't want to say no to the job. And I didn't. So I commuted for three years when our kids were young.
What was the job?
It was running a small innocence project at Loyola Law School in LA.
Okay.
And I really wanted to do it. So I did. And looking back, I kind of can't believe it, because from Monday to Thursday, I was in Los Angeles, and I started doing that when our kids were 3 and 1, and I did it for 3 years. And that's pretty unusual. And it invited, I think, a lot of judgment, and it induced a lot of stress into the marriage.
Yep. You know, one of the people I've talked to for a podcast is a guy named Brad Klontz, who's a financial psychiatrist. And it's a fascinating role. Essentially, he helps people with money problems. And he's a lead dad himself. And he said it's been a lot easier. He just moved to Boulder, Colorado from Hawaii. And the whole system, the whole ecosystem in Boulder is much more welcoming and open to a man being a lead dad than it was when he lived in Hawaii. But he has this premise that, you know, these sort of deep-seated sort of money beliefs force people into roles that they may not want to do. So money and masculinity, the man as the provider, that is, you know, however ridiculous we may think about it, that it is today, it's been sort of drilled into the brain, and it makes it more, you know, difficult for men to sort of step back. I mean, obviously, I'm not trying to make excuses here, but do you think, when you think of those tropes and how we, you know, end them or battle against them, some people are obviously going to be, you know, more able to do it. This was not something that particularly affected me. My wife's always been the higher earner, and I've always been very open about it, but I was very fulfilled for years as a New York Times columnist. When you see, you know, people getting held back from fulfilling their potential, men and women in relationships, is it often these tropes, these stereotypes that hold them back? Is it more that lack of communication? Is it, you know, just a misalignment? Is it just sometimes people have to work a lot? I mean, let's be honest. Sometimes, you know, people aren't both attorneys. Sometimes people are both, you know, jobs where if both of them aren't working, you're not going to pay the bills. I mean, a lot to unpack in that long-winded question. But when you think about it, what are the things that, you know, how do we get past these stereotypes so that, you know, us now in our 40s and 50s can live fulfilling lives, but you know, hopefully our kids can, you know, not make the same mistakes that some of us have made.
I don't think you can underestimate the power of stereotypes, particularly around associating masculinity with breadwinning. And I don't know why it is that in 2022, this still has such a sway over people. The one thing that made me optimistic, among some others, in researching this book, is I really think that is slowly receding as the generations get younger. I think millennials and Gen Z folks are much less invested in that whole idea and not buying into it. And you can just see kind of a general greater level of acceptance of all different kinds of domestic relationships and sexual partnerships, et cetera. And I think that's kind of a piece with it. But certainly for my generation, that really had this fixed hold on a lot of people where they just felt like, well, what kind of a man am I if I'm not bringing home the bacon, which is so reductive when you think about all the different ways in which, as you say, being a lead dad is enormously important, significant labor, both physically, emotionally, and in a sense, financially, because you're saving your family an enormous amount of money. So I don't really understand why it is that we are so slow to embrace that. And also, it seems like other industrialized Western countries have made much greater strides in throwing this stereotype off than we have. Again, it's something about the US that confounds me. We're supposed to be the best country in the world, et cetera. And yet we're so far behind when it comes to so many things, especially having to do with families.
Yeah. You know, well, there is a penalty. You look at the data on what women earn, what men earn, equally smart, equally well-educated, equally capable. And there's a difference we talk about. Often we hear about, you know, the penalty for motherhood and what it does for promotions, what it does for, you know, sort of unconscious bias in you know, managers, male or female, and whether or not they promote a woman. I had a talk with Jamie Ladge, who's a professor at Northeastern. really interesting woman, and she's done some research on a penalty that dads feel they're going to face if they ask for time off. Now, if you say, hey, I'm going to my kid's baseball game, I'm going to my kid's ballet, that's okay. But if you say, you know what, my kid's having a hard time, I would like to just go take a walk with her for an hour and a half, maybe get an ice cream and talk, people look at you like, you know, where's you're not committed to work. How can you not be committed to work? What responsibility, you know, does corporate America bear for some of these problems that we find ourselves in? And what can corporate America do to be better so that men and women aren't penalized for wanting to have a life outside of work, for wanting to have a family and a good relationship?
I think corporate America bears a lot of responsibility, and I'll tell you why. I think these Fortune 500 types, they set the tone in some ways for the larger culture. And what we're seeing is not taking, for example, paternity leave. I mean, it's offered equally to men and women, parent leave, right? And When I was asked, did your ex-husband ever take any? My answer was no, not one day, even though he was entitled to the same amount as a woman in his law firm. It just wasn't done. And until the partners start taking leave, until they start modeling that kind of behavior, the people under them are going to feel too afraid to do it themselves. They're going to be afraid of exactly the kind of judgment that you said. So until people who have the power and the platform and the clout step up and embrace this different way, and quite frankly, a better, healthier way of being a dad, it's going to have a harder time trickling down.
Yeah, I've tried to make the argument that, you know, change starts in the middle, because if you've risen to the top of your profession, whether you're a man or woman, you're going to suffer from confirmation bias. Well-known principle in behavioral economics, you're going to say, hey, I did it this way, and it worked out. Whereas if you're that person, that, you know, emerging manager, you know, formerly known as a middle manager, you're closer to those that group that you're managing, and chances are you're at an age where if you have a family, you're going to be more empathetic to them. But it's sort of empowering those people, because I just don't feel that change is going to come from the top. I mean, it's going to be those managers who are with people day in and day out. And as you said, you know, set the example, you know, take parent leave. I mean, one of the bits of research that Kristen Shockley did was she looked into, you know, the average time off that men take for paternity leave, for parental leave. And the average, and this is blows my mind, the average was one day. So like, if that's the, like, I took a month off. And so like, if the, like, what did I do to skew the average so that it's one day? If you could give, you know, advice to people who are listening, younger, you know, couples, they're trying to figure this out, younger kids, they're both working, and, you know, they're seeking advice because maybe it's not going as smoothly as they thought it would or should. What's some of the advice that you'd give them to help bring a little more, you know, equity to their relationships?
I would say, use the lessons that we've learned from the pandemic to your advantage, because as much death and destruction as it wrought, it also completely upended the way that we think about work. And to some degree, it did away with these artificial notions of FaceTime and rigid schedules, and that flexibility was a bad thing or only for people on the mommy and daddy track. In fact, what it showed was that under incredible stress in a virtual hellscape, parents held on and in some ways performed better and more efficiently under extremely harsh conditions. So I think the key here is to not go back. We don't want to go back to 2019 because that model was pretty inhumane. What we want to do is pivot using what we have learned. What we have learned is that if you give people flexibility and you are humane towards them, they will perform. And what that means is we need to stop demanding that people come in 5 days a week or even 3 days a week if they do not need to. Mm-hmm. We need to say when someone is telling you this shift works better for me than that shift, okay, I understand and I'm going to accommodate you because I know that you're a good worker and your happiness is important. And the thing that we have as workers to our advantage is that there is a tremendous labor scarcity right now. People are desperate to hire across white collar, blue collar, and pink collar industries. And what I've seen in the women that I've been interviewing recently in preparation for a new piece about post-pandemic life is that people are saying, I'm going to leave if you don't give me what I want and I'm going to go somewhere else. It's not that they're saying, I quit, I'm out. They're saying, I quit and I'm going to this other place because they're going to treat me better. And so I guess what I would say to the younger generation who hasn't made all of my mistakes, seize on that.
Yeah. That's perfect. I always like to give my guests the last word, and that was the perfect last word. So Laura Bazelon, author of Ambitious Like a Mother. Thank you for being my guest on the Company of Dads podcast.
I absolutely loved it. Thank you for having me.